Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the Ken Hudson Show. Ken has investigated the strange and unusual for over two decades. He's led ghost tours, and he's accessed the most haunted places in the Southwest. He's the author of some 40 books of the paranormal, unusual, hidden treasure, conspiracies, and the downright strange. His personal experiences and the experiences of many others are related on this show and in his many books. Please sit back, relax, and enjoy as Ken takes us through tales of terror, trauma, and triumph. And now, your host, Mr. Ken.
And good evening. You're listening to Ken Hudnall. This is the Ken Hudnall Show right here on the one and only Log Talk Radio. Coming to you live from our studios right here in El Paso, Texas. Gateway to the Old West and the most haunted city in the country. Now, it's close to the end of another week. And, of course, on this Thursday night, well, they changed my screen. Interesting. On this Thursday night, we have a very special guest for you. Now, part of our basic formats, unsolved mysteries, lost treasures, ghosts, UFOs, hauntings, you name it, if it has to do with the strange and unusual, we talk about it. When I was at the Book Expo of America, I can't talk tonight for some reason. I'm getting fumble-fingered here. I met an author by the name of Kathy Porter, who writes a very interesting series called the Grey Guardian series. And it's about UFOs, and it throws in everything except the kitchen sink. And, of course, when you have a new series that you can get in at the beginning and follow all the nuances, it makes for a very interesting ride. And certainly the Grey Guardian series definitely does that. Now, this first book is Earth's Ultimate Conflict. And we're going to talk to Kathy how this came about and where she plans on going with it. I think you'll enjoy it. It's quite an interesting series. And I'm going to bring her on now. But before I do, I want to make mention of the fact that this hour is brought to you by Marcello's Ristorante Italiano. Two different locations, 1360 Lee Trevino in the Sun Point Shopping Center, and 5380 North Mesa and the Festival Crossing Shopping Center. Now, this is an Italian restaurant unlike any you will find any place else. They've got vegetarian plates, fish, lamb, chicken, veal, and almost every type of pasta you can imagine. The ambiance is like old Italy, and you'll really enjoy a meal out there. And it's a great place to take that special someone. And if you're going to be anywhere around this region and you want to check it out, I have a gift card, $25, which is, unless you plan on eating the place out, is sufficient to take someone out for a nice romantic dinner. And the question you have to ask, but one more time, that I'm asking and you have to answer, and I've said it a number of times, when did I start doing radio and where did I do it? Answer those simple questions, you got yourself a $25 gift card. Now let me bring on Kathy. How are you?
I'm fine, Ken. How are you?
Oh, I'm just having a fun time.
I wanted to thank you very much for having me on your show and your interest in my book, and it was great meeting you at the BEA.
It was definitely nice meeting you. The BEA is something I like to go to every chance I get. You never know what you're going to find.
No, you don't.
And in between the dozens and dozens and dozens of new cookbooks and all this other, it was nice to find a new interesting sci-fi series that dealt with the topic I've written about myself, which is UFOs.
Yes, I saw. You've written lots of books, Ken. So you understand the writing process.
Well, I was asked when I started doing radio, where can we buy your book? And I said, I don't have a book. I'm a talk show host. If you'll go write it, we'll buy it. And one thing led to another, and the first one came out, and now I'm on I've got 42 published by one publishing company and a second one getting ready to be published by another one. So I plan on hitting 50 by year's end.
Well, I look forward to that type of success, Ken.
Well, having looked at Earth's Ultimate Conflict, I think you definitely will get there. But why don't you tell us the premise?
Well, Earth's Ultimate Conflict is the first in the Great Guardian series, as you mentioned. It's a thriller series. And the premise is, what if a worldwide pandemic, increased seismic activity, and global warming were all related to alien abduction? And because of these three issues, Earth in the near future looks like it's in enormous peril. And two alien races appear to offer salvation to mankind. President Barbara Unger is faced with two alien species offering conflicting courses of action, and she's going to have to decide ultimately who to trust, who is friend and who is foe, the Greys or the Guardians. I will tell you this, Ken, I tell all my readers that once you've read Earth's Ultimate Conflict and it's on the cover of my book, you'll never feel the same about that occasional ringing in your ears. But that's the premise.
Well, now, what led you to write the book?
Well, I've had a lifelong interest in what's out there. I have no proof that anything's out there, but I truly believe that we have had UFO visitations since ancient times, if we're not from the UFO species ourselves. And I've listened to you in the past, and I know you think along those lines also, Ken, and I know you talked about ancient civilizations just the other day.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that is ultimately that we have been involved with aliens for some time. And my father, who was a science teacher, sort of honed my interest by, you know, sharing information about space. He took, you know, our entire family out in the backyard on many occasions and taught us the constellations. And we looked at the moon and we talked about what could be out there, what, you know, our future holds in space. He loved science fiction, like watching the old movies, The Day the Earth Stood Still or Invaders from Mars. And we both shared an interest in Mr. Ray Bradbury's book. And thankfully, he endorsed my book. So it's been a lifelong issue with me, wanting to know. You know, I have to tell you this, Ken. One of the most fascinating things that happened in my youth that has kept me interested in UFOs was in 1961, I think it was, Betty and Barney Hill.
The invention
of Betty and Barney Hill. Okay, that was a media frenzy, and it was on everything. And I was, I just soaked it all up and continued to read about alien abduction, and alien abduction investigators have written some excellent books on the subject.
Mm-hmm.
So, it's, over the years, it has, consistently been a theme in my life, you know, looking for some answers. I was going to say that, so when I finally realized that this is my ultimate goal, an early morning dream one morning just came into my head about what could happen in the future. And I just laid there in bed and kept building on the story and suddenly realized I've got the makings of a book. And I talked it over with my husband, and he encouraged me. And so Earth's Ultimate Conflict basically is a dream come true.
Many of my books get started the very same way. It's you get something in your head and you just worry it like a dog with a bone. Go ahead.
And it never went away from that moment, from the day I had the dream that gave me the concept for the book. It became a series, and it's continuing constantly. And I'm sure it does with you. As a writer, your mind never really quite shuts off when you're thinking about your book and where it's going from there and what is happening to these characters that you have created.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that what I write about is very substantial in the fact that it's happening now. What I am writing is happening. I take it to the near future, but we have increased seismic activity. We have what some people believe is global warming. We have the threat constantly of worldwide pandemics, whether they're used politically to scare us and get what they want from us or not is another question, but it's happening now. And I keep telling my film rights agent it needs to be made into a movie before it becomes a reality.
That's quite true. You also have to keep in mind that the Betty and Barney Hill story actually has certain aspects that have really excited people's imaginations. For example, I think it was Barney's description of the pilots. They sounded for all the world like German officers, the way they dressed, the way they walked, the way they talked. And that ties in almost directly to what Admiral Byrd ran into at the South Pole, if you believe a lot of the material that's made the rounds.
Right, right. So it's almost like, it's almost as if what he wrote, what he spoke of then, was part of our history already.
That's right.
Already happening.
And as for global warming, we all know that's Al Gore's fault. Always shoot the messenger.
Pardon me?
Always shoot the messenger.
Yes. That's basically been our history.
Well, the abduction phenomena has really become, it's never really gone away. Now, in California, I know that there's a large group of abductees. They have support groups, and they get together and talk about their abduction experiences.
Yeah.
A lot of the abductees issue newsletters, and they sell tapes, and which makes it difficult to know who's telling the truth and who... And who's making the whole thing up?
Right. Who's cashing in on a situation that for some people is a horrible phenomenon that is happening to them, and for other people it is an issue that they want to exploit. But I do have to mention one author, Whitley Strieber, who wrote Communion.
Yep.
And also the book The Confirmation. And he put alien abduction more in the mainstream because his book, Confirmation, was not put in science fiction. It was put in mainstream fiction, which was a real coup for the abductees out there that were previously just made fun of. And I think it took a whole new turn at that time.
Well, that's true, and the reason that happened was before he wrote that book, he was already a very prominent author and a playwright, and he got into almost everything you could get into. I interviewed him years ago when he came out with, I think it was about communion, because he wrote that 20 years ago.
Oh, yes, at least.
And he went into detail about the fact that, this happened to him, and he wanted to get the story out there, and he was adamant if the bookstores were going to carry it, it had to be in nonfiction.
Right, right. And he had the a little bit more authority in that, since he was such a well-known author at the time. It wasn't Wolf in one of his books that was made into a movie, I believe. And so he was very well-known and had a little more clout, in which was very beneficial to a lot of the people out there that have been abducted and needed their story told.
And then, let's see, who was the other one? Bud Hopkins.
Bud Hopkins, yeah.
Who wrote about the abduction experience, missing time, and the fact that the way the abductions take place is the same way that we track animal bloodlines.
Oh, interesting.
Because there'll be abductions in many generations of the same family.
Yes. Yes, that is true. And some people have a double, what would you call it, a double whammy. You know, not only are they being abducted, as you said, they take it in family lines, and they can do nothing to prevent the abduction of their children later on in life.
That's true. Additionally, I've talked to some abductees, one of whom, Krista Tilton? I don't remember which one it was. She actually went through the pregnancy experience, where she's pregnant one day and the next day she's not.
Right. And many, many abductees tell us that, which is, I also mentioned it in my book about the pregnancies and the disappearing pregnancies.
Yeah. And, of course, you have to wonder, either these people are getting together and discussing it, or the same thing's happening to a large group of people because the details are almost word for word.
Right, and their drawings are all similar also. When they're asked to draw what the aliens look like that they have seen, or what the rooms look like that they are in, the descriptions of the type of medical exam that they receive is all similar. I don't believe that you can take people from all walks of life, from all areas of the United States, and in fact all areas of the world, and get the same story, and it was some kind of conspiracy between all these people. You know, not all those people got together and discussed it. So it is based in reality, in my belief.
Or reality as they perceive it.
As they perceive it, right.
Now, a number of those who have been abducted that I've talked with, some of the details would be hard for them to make up because it involved, the interior of certain facilities. And yet, they've been right on the money with details.
Right. So it's hard to refute what they are saying. And it's hard to understand why nothing is done about it.
Yeah. Of course, you don't know what the government's really doing. You know what the government is saying. But you don't know what they're really doing.
No, we don't. And there are many things that they may be doing that we are not privy to. But we're not the War of the Worlds generation anymore. We're not going to freak out if we know that aliens are here and we need to do something about it. I think they need to be a little more upfront about it. In fact, recently the Catholic Church, the Vatican, has come out and said that, you know, aliens wouldn't do anything to discredit their religion, that aliens would be our brothers and sisters from space. It wouldn't be, I just feel that if the Vatican's looking into it, which they are, they're gathering reports from all over the world, something is happening that we need to know about.
Something is happening we're not being told about.
Right.
Now, the reason it was hushed up in the beginning in 47, is the fact that we're the most powerful country in the world, and yet we couldn't figure out who's flying in our atmosphere.
Right, that this is true.
You know, we had just finished a major war, and if we're the most powerful country in the world, and these entities are able to come and go as they please, you have to ask yourself, just how powerful are they?
They must be enormously powerful for it to be kept so secretive. I imagine that the spacecraft that they did capture in 47, if in fact they did, holds enormous secrets that even to this day they haven't been able to decipher. But I they have made some progress.
I know Barry Goldwater, who was a reserve general, asked Curtis LeMay, who commanded Wright-Patterson, if he could go in Hangar 18. And LeMay had a fit and said, "Don't ever ask me again. Even I don't have clearance to go in that building, and I command the post."
Mm-hmm.
Goldwater, at his position, wasn't going to say something that would could come back and bite him. So I'm pretty confident that's what happened. And if there were things that even the commander of the post, who has enormous power, can't see because his clearance isn't high enough, then we're dealing with some very serious information.
Right. I agree. And I think that it continues to be something that they move about. I think because they are so fearful and so secretive about what they are doing, they move these things around,
mm-hmm.
whatever it is that they have, so that after a while they can open it up to the public and say, "See, there's nothing here." Or they'll tell us it was a new aircraft that they were testing and building, things of that nature. But very often what people have reported to see and what their secret craft is are two different things.
Mm-hmm. Well, also you have to keep in mind that people react so strangely. A few years ago we went to to Roswell, to their 4th of July event. And they just opened up, for the very first time, the hangar on what used to be Roswell Army Air Corps base there. And it was Army Air Corps before it was changed to the Air Force in 47. And this was the hangar where everything was taken after it was collected from Mac Brazil's farm. And there was a guy crawling around on the ground picking up all the nuts and bolts he could find and putting them in little test tubes. And he was going to put them on eBay and it's going to make him a fortune. And I made the comment, "Don't you think, since this was used as a commercial airport for quite some time, that anything from the UFO is probably long since gone?" I mean, he just couldn't quite grasp the fact that it wasn't there anymore.
Right. No, these things keep moving around. I'm sure that what we believe in Roswell isn't there. I'm sure it has been moved elsewhere. And pardon me?
I said certainly.
Yes, and I think it continues to move around. I used that example in my book that, you know, we were made to believe it went to Roswell, where in actuality it was sent somewhere else. And they actually sent trucks there to Roswell with covered, you know, what could be crafts, and they were taken to Roswell, Area 51, but actually were taken elsewhere. And this happens, I think, over and over again as they try to, you know, make us believe that nothing is really there, when in actuality they've made that move so that we can then find out that nothing is there.
what we're looking for
is now in Minot Air Force Base.
Years ago, I took a busload of people to Area 51. And this was before the black mailbox was sold and went on tour.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of very strange things were seen. And a lot of the folks were, there were 40-some people on the bus, and everybody had a camera, and rolls and rolls and rolls of photographs were taken, and not a single picture came out.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
How interesting.
Absolutely baffling. You would have thought at least one or two pictures would have come out. I mean, there were some folks who were as close as you could be to professional photographers there, and none of their pictures came out either.
So it was several cameras that none of the pictures came out on.
About 24 of the people, I don't know why that number remains so clear in my memory, 24 of the people contacted me after we got back to say that each one had taken 6 or 8 rolls of pictures, and none of them had a picture that came out.
What could have caused that, I wonder?
According to the development place, every one of them appeared to be overexposed, so perhaps radiation?
Oh,
which is an interesting way for the government to make sure nobody got pictures they shouldn't be having.
Yeah, that is an interesting way.
Now, I got the opportunity
Have you been back since? No.
The little alien is closed down now. Though I understand it's open periodically. That was the primary business in town when I was there. That and renting little, they had a lot of Gulfstream trailers set around the desert. And they would rent them to people who wanted to stay and, you know, several days and go looking for UFOs.
Mm-hmm.
It was a very strange place.
I can imagine. I haven't been there myself yet. I intend to go in the near future and take a look as well as I can, but I hear there's not much you can see.
Well, the government made another land grab. Freedom Ridge used to be open if you wanted to scale it. And you could go up there and look down and see the outline of the facility.
Mm-hmm.
And the government seized all that land. And, of course, they have the camo guys who crawl through the bushes, basically having fun playing army, I guess. We found a bunch of – I grew up on a farm, and I know what a chicken track looks like. And we found a bunch of chicken tracks – that I couldn't cover with my hand.
Wow.
And that was a little surprising. A chicken that big, I would not want to meet.
Nor would I. That is very interesting.
But it was, I had made the announcement, Billy Goodman out of Las Vegas, who had a show called The Billy Goodman Happening.
Mm-hmm.
He wanted me to get a busload of people and come meet him at a vortex spot there in the desert. And this was like on a Monday he called me, and I said, well, I'll mention it, but I doubt I can get a busload of people together that fast. And I said, if we have enough people to fill the bus, when we leave, ready to leave on Friday, we'll go, and if we don't, the trip's off. The bus seated 42, I think, and I had to turn away over 50.
Oh, my.
So we went, and it was a truly bizarre weekend.
I can imagine. What type of sights did you see?
Well, the bus somehow managed to drive through Rachel without noticing that that's where we were at, which I thought was strange. A number of people reported missing time, and a number of them underwent hypnosis when we got back because they wouldn't let it go. They just kept worrying at it. And some of what that came out in those hypnotic regression sessions were strange themselves.
Really?
We saw all kinds of lights coming out of Area 51. And
many people believe that what's at Area 51 is actually government flying objects, UFOs.
Well, Bob Lazar, who was a guy who went public and said that he had been hired to reverse engineer some UFOs that the government had possession of.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of what he said was confirmed. From McCarran Airport there at Vegas, a 747 with blacked out windows would fly out every morning and land at Area 51. Groom Lake, we used to be a lake that's now dried up, and it's got a huge airstrip. And he said that every day they would come, they would be forced to undergo a search going in and a search coming out, and they would then be allowed to go to their duty stations. And his happened to be trying to reverse engineer the propulsion system of a UFO. Now, whether you believe Lazar was telling the truth or was just a total fruitcake or perhaps a disinformation agent,
mm-hmm.
is irrelevant. What he said was consistent when he did his talks. Now, there's a lot of people that went on the UFO speaking tour and made an incredible amount of money because, UFO fanatics love to hear anything about UFOs.
Right.
And there's certainly a lot of fanatics out there.
But you just mentioned something, disinformation agents, which I do talk about in Earth's Ultimate Conflict. And I truly believe that they can even take maybe, people that are, have no real interest in UFOs but are kind of lost in the world and convince them that they have been abducted and give them disinformation so that we have some people that are talking about being abducted, but we can say, well, they're a nutcase. In that way of using disinformation, by having people come out and tell the truth about what is happening to some people, but they're so really out of touch.
You remember the book, The Philadelphia Experiments? Charles Berlitz wrote it with someone who was real big in the UFO community at that time, and I don't know, frankly, I'm blanking on his name. But he eventually went public and said he had been hired by the government to be a disinformation agent, put out information that would just send people in the wrong direction.
Mm-hmm.
And
yeah, I believe there's plenty of them out there.
Yeah, he was, he had a hell of a career as an author, writing about the Philadelphia Experiment and all kinds of strange things, and suddenly he's trying to confuse people about UFOs. It's confusing enough without all that.
Absolutely. absolutely. And it's hard to decipher a fact from fiction with all the disinformation that is put out there and all the people who have got on the bandwagon just for financial gain rather than seeking the truth or telling the truth of a situation.
When I first started writing, anything that would let me put my books in front of the public, I went to. There was the Whole Earth Expo, and I went to a bunch of those, and there's some truly strange people in this world.
Yes, and there are.
I got to meet most of them.
Well, it's the nature of what you talk about.
Oh, that's true. And it was always, when they would tell their stories, the stories would always be borderline crazy, but the jury was still out. It could have gone either way, especially with the abductees.
Mm-hmm.
And there's probably been 50 books written by people who swear they were abducted and taken to the underground alien base at Dulce, New Mexico. And one individual actually sent me what she called the report, which to anyone else she sold for $19.95, but she sent it to me because I was doing a show. And she had chapter and verse on security measures and multiple underground levels, and it was like reading a government report, and you're sitting there going, this woman has to be crazy as a loon, but it's hanging together.
Right. And certainly throughout the world, we have found underground cities.
Oh, yes. Some of them date back to the earliest times.
Right.
And there's been stories about...
Recently, we have the new discovery under the Sphinx.
That's right. They dug down 120 feet, I think.
Mm-hmm.
And they found what they said was an underground depository of papyrus, which fits the ancient stories about the underground Hall of Records that was supposedly hidden there by the ancients.
Right. Wouldn't it be fascinating to get a look at what's there?
Yes, but Dr. Hawassi is not going to let anybody get in there to figure out how to make money off of it.
Of course. Of course.
But so much of what's coming to light these days falls right in line with what the ancient records say is supposed to be there.
Yes, this is true. And if I know many people that have studied the ancient civilizations and are concerned about the Mayan calendar and what's going to happen in 2012, and I'm not so sure. I believe it will be a destruction as much as I think it will be an awakening, a change in our human mentality.
Well, you also have to keep in mind that the Bible talks about wormwood. And we've got the ancient Sumerians who talk about Nibiru. And the calendar for the return of Nibiru is supposed to be around 2012.
Mm-hmm.
And if you go back in history and you look carefully, you'll find a disruption of civilization about every 3,500 to 4,000 years, which is, according to Zachariah Sitchin, the time it takes Nibiru to go through its long elliptical orbit and come back.
Yes, I did hear something about that would that was a factor, and that that timetable was a factor. And that can probably explain why there are so many civilizations that have, you know, either disappeared or gone somewhere.
You also have to keep in mind that some of the discoveries in Turkey, one of which was in the ancient kingdom of Cappadocia, they found an underground city large enough to hold a population of about 200,000, multiple levels. And
isn't that fascinating? I was looking at that a few months back. It was just fascinating, and it was beautiful under there, what they had.
Yep, but you have to ask yourself, why would they abandon their homes and move underground? Well, if they're escaping something like the return of Nibiru, it makes excellent sense.
Yes, it does. And it's I sort of used a little bit of that in my book, Earth's Ultimate Conflict, on the planet Noor, that their civilization had moved underground.
And if
I think it happens. I think it is something that has happened in our past, and in not just one time, but probably several times over.
Well, as far back as you care to go in Earth history, you find disruptions of civilization, and one of them falls squarely during the time frame that Atlantis is supposed to have sunk. Well, a planet the size of Nibiru, based on the ancient descriptions, coming through this solar system would cause such tremendous gravitational upheavals that it could well sink a continent.
Well, it could either sink a continent, or we just tilt on our axis, and one continent that was previously in a very, in the equator area could then be one of our poles.
That's right. Which might explain the extinction of the dinosaurs a whole lot better than the comet theory.
I agree. I agree there. I'm not thrilled with that comet theory.
They do a lot of supposition, and then when someone who disagrees with them comes up with a theory, then they're accused of dealing in supposition and not in true facts.
Right.
Because science is never going to admit that some of what they call science fiction might be true.
Right. And science fiction has proved itself to be true over and over again. I mean, look at as far back as, well, not that far back, but Jules Verne's From Earth to the Moon, and we've been on the moon. We've got robots on Mars. We're a civilization that has made enormous scientific advances. Robots were just science fiction, and now, you know, Japan and the U.S. have made enormous advances in creating robots.
And if you look at Alternative 3, a lot of what was written there is turning out to be based in fact, in spite of the allegations that it was all April Fool's joke, and it talks about underground civilizations on Mars, and now it looks like that there's a lot of evidence that supports those underground civilizations. I was reading something the other day where they're finding a lot of signs that there is still life on Mars, and it would have to be underground based upon surface conditions.
Right. And then we also have within our own solar system the solar flares that can do damage besides other environmental and spatial objects that can cause destruction. But we have solar flares that could possibly cause enormous damage. And we really have no protection against that.
That's true. We're sitting here fat, dumb, and happy. And I mentioned on my show the other night that we're worried about terrorists and somebody dropping a bomb on us when we're flying through a universe that's full of junk. And it's amazing we haven't run head-on into something.
That's true. That's true. I mean, things have passed that are light years away from us, but 80 light years away from us is pretty close.
Yes, it is. And yet our government is not going to tell us because they don't want to worry people. Well, I'd like to know if something's going to hit so I can at least crawl into the bed.
Right. Or prepare yourself for meeting your maker.
That's quite true. But, no, it's ever since the Robertson panel back in the 50s, the government's philosophy has been, let's not worry the public. And Heidi...
You feel that war of the worlds mentality that they're stuck in, as if we haven't advanced as a civilization. We're not going to run helter-skelter screaming in the streets and ducking into sewers.
Actually, that has a place. There comes a time when the best thing to do is to duck into the sewers.
Yes, it's true, but I don't think it'll cause the kind of havoc they're expecting if they would just come out and explain and be truthful about it, so that we have even years ahead of time, if you know there's a possibility of something coming and we're trying to, you know, prevent it and we're doing the best that we can, but here's what you can do to save yourself, you know, giving us the opportunity instead of hiding things.
Well, if the government admitted that, let's say, now, there's been a lot of things written by amateur astronomers that there is a large, it's been described as a brown dwarf, that's heading this way. Now, it meets all the characteristics of Nibiru, or Wormwood, or whatever you want to call it.
Mm-hmm.
If the government admitted it was coming, the economy would collapse, because why save and why invest if everything's going to be knocked into kindling? Why not go out in one last major party? And I think the government is quite concerned with the general, well, the end is coming, so what the hell attitude?
Well, I think, that's very valid what you're saying. Those are very valid reasons for not telling us, but certainly giving us at least a little notice so we can prepare for our end, our demise, if that's what's going to happen, or find a way, if they don't find a way, if they can't find a way to prevent it. I think they kind of owe it to us to allow us to meet the end the way we see fit.
Well, I think I agree with you. They do owe it to us, but the problem is most presidents don't want to admit there's something they can't handle, and that's why we wind up with messes like we've got right now. I think what you're going to see is there'll be a speech going on. Somebody will hand the president a note. He'll look at it and say, well, in ending the speech, I just want to say, there is a rock the size of Nebraska that's going to obliterate the moon and land somewhere outside of Philadelphia. Y'all be careful now, you hear? And then he's going to take out for his bunker. That'll be the warning we'll get.
You may have predicted the future there.
Hey, that's my job. Now, how many books do you plan on having in your series?
At this time, I know there's going to be 6, possibly 7.
7?
Possibly. Oh. I know for sure 6.
And when do you expect to have the next one?
The next one will be out next year. hopefully early to mid next year.
And
it literally continues from the day after the first book ends.
So you're going to keep it a tight-knit book, in other words.
Right. Each book is a standalone novel in itself. It has a very satisfactory ending, and but it does keep you wanting more. It makes you, you become very involved with the characters and the storyline. So I continue it from the very next day, and many of the characters are reprised in the next book, certainly many of the main characters.
Okay. And where can I get the book?
Earth's Ultimate Conflict, the first in the Great Guardian series, is available on Amazon.com. It's available in Borders, Barnes & Noble, all your retail outlets. If they don't have it now, they will gladly order it for you.
Okay.
It's so new on the market right now that you got one of the first books, Ken.
Well, I appreciate that. It makes for a very interesting read.
Thank you.
And the, you know, I've been writing so long, and I read anything, it's like, you know, at this point I'd do this, or at this point I'd do that. Why didn't he do this? They're coming. But I enjoyed it.
Thank you.
And we've got about 8 minutes left in this segment. What else would you like to say about your series?
Well, you know, I told you basically the premise of the book, but maybe a little bit more about some of the characters. For instance, Rosa DeAngelo is from Endicott, New York, which is my hometown, one of the main characters, and she is forced to flee Earth with her three alien hybrid children. And she'll be forced to leave the love of her life, and her soulmate, Tony, behind. And Ellen McCarthy, who is from Los Alamitos, California, has to make the agonizing choice of abandoning her love-starved hybrid children or finding a way back to her three-month-old human child, Griffin, before it's too late. Earth's inhabitants will be facing seemingly insurmountable problems, and both Rosa and Ellen are victims of the C's, severe environmental allergy syndrome, the pandemic that is sweeping the world at the time. So that's the basis of the book and a little glimpse of some of my characters. And plus, Earth's Ultimate Conflict president of the United States is President Barbara Unger, our first female president. I think it makes a really interesting read. Most of my readers have been men, but many women that have read it, and some women kind of shy away from science fiction because it's the techno stuff, they find my type of science fiction very touching and very, it involves women and women's issues and children. And so if you've never read a science fiction novel before, this is the one to read.
Well, we've done almost an hour interview, and for those who like science fiction, it's an excellent book. But if you like action adventure, I think you'll find the Earth's Ultimate Conflict is a book you need to put on your reading list.
Thank you very much, Ken, for that plug.
Go down to Barnes & Noble routinely carries the books that I talk about on the show. And they have reported a lot of interest because they hear about it here on the show.
Also, it just recently won the Indie Excellence Book Award for Science Fiction.
Oh, very good.
Thank you.
I definitely appreciate you taking the time to be with me. And when
I enjoyed this very much, Ken. You're a very excellent interviewer. I enjoyed listening to your show.
Well, thank you. Are you one of the guests that signed in?
I am signed in.
As one of the guests?
Well, I'm online. Don't I have to sign in to be online?
Well, you can listen to me, or it also shows me I have guests that haven't signed in. They're just coming to listen.
Oh.
If you register, you can mark this as one of your favorite shows, and it'll tell you when I'm coming up.
Oh, I will do that. I will do that. I actually just bookmarked you and just turn you on while I'm writing in the evening.
Well, I appreciate that.
You're welcome.
I never turn down the opportunity to get turned on. When you get to be mine, you need to take all the chances you can. Well, I appreciate you being with me. When your next book comes out, if you'll let me know, then we'll get you back on for another interview.
I appreciate that, and I will, Ken. Thank you very much.
You're quite welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Heidi, my system's acting up again. Would you break the connection, please? Okay, that was, how are you, Carla? It's always nice to have you with me. And yes, Ted will be here during the third hour, talking about movies. Now, I've, from time to time, we'll schedule an hour or two, or sometimes I'll take the entire show. I just feel like talking that night. And I'll talk about strange and unusual things. And you all know that many of my books I've written about unsolved mysteries and ghosts and the strange and supernatural. But there's more to the supernatural than turns volume up louder. Who knew percolators were so flipping loud? Is he? Well, I'll be sure to tell him that. Now, I'd appreciate all you all who listen to my show to send a friend request, which is something that Blog Talk Radio sets up. I need all the friends I can get. And we're getting ready to do something unusual and different in the next 60 days or so. And I think you all will... I think y'all will really enjoy Deacon Wells. I think so too, Gray Artist, but it never hurts to check. Now, ghosts come back for many reasons. Sometimes unfinished business, sometimes guarding treasure, sometimes for revenge. Now, one of the best revenge cases that I've come across was in 1884. A British yacht called the Piera capsized in the Atlantic in July of 1884. Only four men survived. They were managed to find one of the dinghies. And they drifted for 25 days. By that 25th day, they were near death from starvation and exposure. And let me tell you, the Atlantic at any time is warm out there under the sun. But in July, you were baked. Finally, the captain, who was one of the four who survived, came up with a last desperate suggestion. He said they didn't know how long they were going to be there, so they needed to draw lots to determine which of the four would be killed and barbecued so the others could survive. Now, two of the sailors agreed with the captain, but the youngest, who was 18, protested he'd rather die than eat human flesh. Well, at the first opportunity, the captain gave him his wish. Kid fell asleep. Captain snuck up and drove a knife through his neck. Now, the other two with the captain had absolutely no reservations about cannibalism. They wanted to survive. 4 days later, they were rescued after having munched on the kid for 4 days. And they said it tastes like chicken. The captain of the ship that rescued them took one look at the remains of the young man and knew exactly what had happened. The survivors of the original ship wanted to bury him at sea, and the captain said no. The body was thoroughly dead. Understand that. And he had been gnawed on for 4 days. So they wrapped the body in a tarp and put it in the hold of the ship. All three were tried and condemned for murder on the high seas, but the Home Secretary, after hearing the story, decided perhaps there had been enough horror, and he commuted their sentence to 6 months imprisonment. And as Chaska says, people are good if you cook them right. But no one could have known what would come from this. Now, when these three were released from prison, they had no hope for the future. Nobody was going to hire them to work on a ship when they'd been munching on their shipmates. One of them, one of the sailors, found work as a drayman. In other words, he led a horse. Don't go, it's a cookbook, how to serve. Yeah, you're absolutely right. I'm sure you find yourself, Heidi. Heidi can probably find herself. She usually knows where she's at. Sometimes I get lost and have to find out where I'm at. But this particular sailor, a man just woke my heart, broke my heart. I want to know how to fricassee him. A little lard, some olive oil, and problem is getting him in the microwave. Sometimes the door pops open. Now this guy led his horse and wagon around. He'd pick up various things with fava beans. Yeah, that works too. And if you've ever been to London, quite often it's overcast. In the early morning hours, quite often there is stick a frozen fish under his seat and just wait. Not many people are going to sit on a frozen fish, Heidi. You need to keep that in mind. And if you ask him to let him put something under you, that may seem a little fishy to the guy. He might jump up and yell, "Holy mackerel," you never know. Anyway, something in the fog scared the horses, and they took off running, knocking Dudley, who was the name of the sailor, to the cobblestones, and split his head open. Nothing was ever found that was could be looked at as responsible. Witnesses said the thing in the fog had been a figure covered in head to foot in bloodstained bandages. But after the horses not Dudley to the cobblestones, the figure just seemed to vanish. Now the captain was taken back by the description because it matched the description of the young man that had been eaten on, because he had been wrapped up in bandages when he was placed in the morgue, because no one wanted to see the big gaping holes that had been chewed into him. So the captain decided to go look for the other sailor, and he found him down in the slums. Put raw shrimp. Oh, in the bedpost of the jerk. Okay. Now, the captain wasn't about to believe it was the dead guy come back to life, so he told the other sailor that it was probably relatives of the dead man who was trying to freak him out by wrapping themselves up in bandages. And he wanted the sailor to help him find whoever was behind this. But the sailor was too far gone in his alcohol days, and all he wanted to do was have another drink. And he got the DDTs. So he was taken to the charity ward of a hospital where he died, the screaming fit. Witnesses said that when they came in, another patient, all wrapped up in bandages, was holding the guy down, trying to soothe him. When the old man had his fatal heart attack, no one could find the patient wrapped up in bandages. Now, the captain was beside himself with fear and worry, because he knew beyond a shadow of a doubt he'd be next. And he was now positive that it might be the dead man. So he went to the police and told them what had happened and how he was sure it was the dead man. DDTs. Yes, that's when you have delirium from alcohol. What do you mean we never stay on topic? We always stay on topic. The topic just kind of varies. Now, the police had no idea how to arrest a ghost, if a ghost it was, but they just took pity on the guy and said, lock him up for the night where nobody could get to him. So they put him in one of the cells, and twice he got up from his bunk to check and make sure he was locked in. Last night we got into outhouses, remember? I didn't go in an outhouse myself. We have indoor plumbing. DTs and not DDTs. Well, let me say this about that. When you're that drunk, you stutter. So it's DDT. The moral of the story is be careful who you eat. That's true, because sometimes your meal comes back on you. Anyway, it was a cell block that contained the drunk tank, so there was always screams coming out of there. But about 3 a.m., the police heard the captain absolutely going berserk. They ran back, unlocked the door, and found him laying on the bunk, dead. His face frozen in fear. What's indoor plumbing? That's where water comes into a room in your house. Sometimes it's called a kitchen. Sometimes it's called a bathroom. Sometimes it's called a restroom. But clutched in the captain's dead, stiff fingers, they found shreds of cotton and blood-stained gauze. Have you heard the story about the ship that appears to people who've gotten away with something, some horrible thing in the past, and they die soon after seeing the ship? No, I haven't. Of course, we have the Flying Dutchman, which has been seen by a number of other ships. In fact, there's several stories along the East Coast of ghost ships that appear regularly. There's one ship, I think it's New England. I don't remember the specific port, where it's on fire, and it comes in with sails billowing to crash against the shore, and when people run down to see if they can save whoever was on board the ship, there's nothing there. Now, we've all heard of serial killers. But what do you do about a serial killer who's actually a ghost? The deadliest ghostly killer of all time was the 19th century Phantom of 30 Berkeley Square in London. Now, London has got some of the most bizarre ghosts you'd ever want to meet. And this one was feared by many. No one knows who it was in life, but and in death, no one really got a good description, because few who saw it lived to tell the tale. And those who did survive, those few, those lucky few, were generally reduced to incoherence from fright. One of the earliest victims was Sir Robert Warboys. Now, he was a member of the nobility. Rather wealthy, rather well-known. And he always liked proving others wrong. And he heard the story of 50 Berkeley Square. I'm always saying 30, it's 50. Some friends of his at the local gentleman's club told him the story and dared him to spend the night in that deadly house. And of course, he readily agreed. The landlord, on the other hand, while agreeable that he could spend the night there, especially after a little money changed hands, insisted that he take a gun. And if anything unusual happened, there was a cord by the bed that would ring a bell downstairs. And Sir Robert was to pull the cord, and they would immediately come and rescue him. Well, about a little after 11, Sir Robert retired to the mystery room. The landlord and some of his friends were sitting downstairs, and almost precisely at midnight, the bell began to ring frantically. Then they heard a shot. The door was still locked. The landlord quickly opened it. They ran inside and found Sir Robert dead. Not from a bullet wound, but his face was frozen in a look of sheer terror. The bullet he had fired was never found. Whatever he shot, he hit. Coroner said he died of fright. Years later, a couple of sailors from Portsmouth were wandering London, looking for a place to stay they could afford, and they walked into Berkeley Square and noticed a sign on the house that said, rooms to let. Now, they didn't know about the strange happenings inside that house. When they inquired, they were told that there was one room that was free. So they were ecstatic to find free lodgings for the night, to get out of the night air. Now, by this time, the house itself was in a fairly run-down condition. And the rooms were neglected, full of trash. But they found a relatively tidy bedroom on the top floor, the one they'd been told was free. One of the sailors fell asleep, but the other one, something about the atmosphere really upset him. And as he lay there, tossing and turning, he heard strange footsteps coming toward the door. He woke up his friend, and the two men watched as the door slowly opened, and something large and dark and shapeless entered. It cornered one of the sailors in the room, and the second one took this opportunity to crash through the door and race downstairs into the street, yelling for help as he went. He found a policeman and told him the story. And they hurried back to the strange house. Well, when they entered, they found the body of the other sailor. His neck was broken. In fact, almost every bone in his body was broken. And on his face was a terrified grimace. He lay on the basement stairs. Whatever had killed him had brought him down from the top floor. The house was bought not too long after that and converted back into a home. A young lady guest was put in that room because there was no other empty room in the house. During the night, she was heard to screaming in terror. When rescuers arrived, she had lost her senses. There was a man who slept there one night to prove that there was nothing unusual about the room. And he was found dead the next morning. The house was immediately put on the market, but no one wanted to buy. But it was rented by a family who used those top floors as quarters for their servants. One morning, one of the maids was found crumpled on the floor, whimpering, "Don't let it touch me." She was taken to the hospital where she died shortly after. Do you have to disclose that to the buyer? There are some states that if you know the house is haunted, you must disclose it. There are other states where if you say the house is haunted, folks look at you like you're crazy. Now, intrigued by the stories about this house, a peer of the realm, an earl. In fact, he made quite a name for himself in regard to the paranormal. His name was Lord Littleton. Said he was going to spend a night in the haunted room. And he took with him two guns, one filled with shot and the other filled with silver sixpenny pieces. You know, if silver bullets work against werewolves, it should work against most anything. And during the night, he saw a shape come through the door and move toward him. And he fired both pistols. Well, perhaps the charms or the silver bullets or whatever, something caused the creature to leave. Middleton survived. In fact, he wrote a book called Notes and Queries, published in 1879, where he told this as well as a number of other stories about the supernatural. Well, today, 50 Berkeley Square is a bookstore. And there have been no reports of the creature. But then again, perhaps that room has been carefully shut up. Now, another strange place in England is Breckles Hall in Norfolk. Doors bang, mysterious footsteps are heard, and sometimes in the ballroom, and many of these old manor homes had ballrooms, spectral dancers stage a ghostly ball. Now, early in the 1900s, a body was found just outside the front door of that hall. It was the body of a local poacher by the name of Mace. He and another man had gotten drunk in the local pub and decided to go bag a few partridges on the hall grounds. They knew the hall was empty. They had been told that some nights the windows were lit with light as a ghostly ball took place. Well, they were very lucky in bagging their limited birds. And as egging each other on, they decided to go see if they could bag a ghost or two. Now, they saw nothing, and looking in all the windows, and they turned to leave. When a coach, well, about four horses, came into view at the bottom of the drive, they were riveted to the spot. I mean, this was like nothing they'd ever seen. They were just frozen in place. And they watched this phantom coach come to a halt, and a truly beautiful woman got out of it, bedecked in jewels, beautiful dress, and she approached and stopped right in front of Mace, and they locked eyes, and after a few moments, Mace gave a piercing scream and collapsed. Well, his friend didn't wait around to make the acquaintance of the young lady. He took off running, went to the nearest house for help, but he couldn't get anybody to go with him. Carla, what's happened? You've left. I'm always being abandoned. Chaska's gone. Well, the next morning, the local vicar got word of what was going on, and he led some villagers over to the old hall. How are you, gray artist? I'm glad to see you. Depends on the state. We're in Texas. Found the poacher. He had the features of his face was frozen in a look of sheer terror. His body was in rigor mortis. In 1804, in Hammersmith, in London, Texas has a disclosure agreement to a point. I never disclose on camera. And that's why, since my first wife was Catholic, it just didn't work out because when I was asked to confess, I'd always ask for an attorney or plead the fifth, one or the other. In 1804, a white phantom brought terror. They have to disclose murders, suicides, and traumatic deaths of that nature. Well, now, murder or suicide is a legal distinction. And it takes a coroner's inquest to determine that, so you can't say someone has been murdered. You need to go to confession. Well, you can do that online, you know. Confession.com. Now, this was an interesting haunting. A woman crossing a local churchyard saw it at first. She, not the same. Why isn't it the same? The woman turned to run, but it grabbed her, and she fainted. And the problem is, she never got over her fear and died just a few days later. There were 16 people in a cart who all were forced to abandon the cart when the ghost appeared before the horse. And this got the local vigilante group up in arms, and they kept watch on the churchyard. And on the fourth night, a customs officer spotted a figure in white coming through the cemetery. He was armed. He took aim and fired, and the figure fell. But it wasn't a ghost. It was a bricklayer coming home late from work wearing white coveralls. The customs officer was sentenced to death for manslaughter. Appealed, and his sentence was commuted to a year in jail. Now, sometimes ghosts kill. And sometimes those ghosts aren't the remnants of a human. There was a Phantom No. 7 bus that haunted one section of London. It was usually seen in the early hours of the morning. The year was 1936. The driver of a car had swerved and hit a wall, and a coroner's inquest was held. Witnesses said that it swerved to avoid a bus, and the bus was ablaze with lights, and as soon as the car hit the wall, the bus vanished. Other witnesses said they'd seen the bus as well. And a bus inspector swore that he'd seen it pull into his depot, and as soon as the engine stopped, it vanished. There hadn't been any reports of that bus killing others since 1936, but you never know. Sometimes ghosts save lives. There was a ship plowing through the North Atlantic off the Canadian coast. A sailor went to talk to the captain, knocked and opened the captain's door, and there sitting at the captain's desk writing in the logbook was a complete and total stranger. He had no idea who it was. It was not someone he'd ever seen on that ship before. He immediately went on deck to find the captain, told him what he had seen. They returned to the captain's cabin. It was empty. They searched the ship one end to the other. The strange man was not seen, but in the logbook, in a strange hand, was written, "Steer to the northeast." The captain did exactly that. And after some hours of sailing on that course, they came across a ship in trouble. It was sinking. They took the survivors on board, and the sailor who had seen the strange man was helping the survivors over the side of the ship, and suddenly came face to face with the man he had seen writing in the logbook. At the captain's request, that man wrote, steered to the northeast, and it was compared to the strange handwriting in the logbook, and it matched. During World War I, a driver of the 42nd Field Ambulance was taking a badly wounded soldier to a casualty depot. A flare lit the night, and the driver saw right in front of him, standing in the middle of the road, a sentry. He slammed on the brakes, got out to see what the problem was, and couldn't find a soul. But right behind where that sentry had been standing was a vast shell crater. Had he not stopped, log talk is worse than trying to navigate Facebook. I agree with you. And if it wasn't for the fact that I built a hell of an audience here, you fell off and had a heck of a time getting in again. And blog talk tells me that the system works beautifully and no one has any problems except me. And they don't have hackers. There was a doctor by the name of Mitchell who was a very prominent doctor in Philadelphia back in the 1800s. And he was dozing after a hard day's work when someone knocked at his door. He opened the door and there was a thin girl wearing a shawl who begged him to come and treat her desperately ill mother. Now, Dr. Mitchell was never one to turn down a request for help, so he bundled up. It was cold and it was snowing. And he followed the young lady through a blizzard to the house where her mother lay ill with pneumonia. He sent for medicine, made the woman comfortable. And as he treated her, to make conversation and take her mind off the fact she felt so bad, he mentioned the fact that had her daughter not come and gotten him, she might not have lasted a night. And the woman looked at him with complete and total confusion and told him that her daughter had died a month ago. Now, certain that could not be the case, the doctor got up and searched the house, didn't find the girl. He did find the shawl hanging in a cupboard. Warm, dry, and not a trace of snow on it. He had followed a ghost through a blizzard to save her mother. You know, strange, very strange things can change history. In the 1880s, Britain's ambassador to Paris, Lord Dufferin, was staying with friends in Ireland. And one night he was restless. He would wake up and drift off. And finally he got up and glanced out the window, and he saw a hunched figure with an ugly, grizzled face carrying a coffin on one shoulder across the lawn. Well, he couldn't figure out what the man was doing there, so he threw open the window and called to him, and the figure vanished. The next morning at breakfast, he mentioned to his host, what he had seen, and the host was mystified. Well, your mother was a regular visitor for a couple of years after she died. A number of people have reported seeing dead relatives for at least a short period of time after they died. Now, a few years later, he was at a diplomatic reception at the Grand Hotel in Paris. Lord Dufferin walked toward the elevator and saw the same ugly, grizzled man again in a servant's uniform. Well, remembering the vision he had had, he knew he should not take that elevator. And as a result of not taking that elevator, he missed dying. When the elevator reached the fifth floor, the cable snapped and it fell to the bottom of the shaft. Everyone inside was killed. Sometimes ghosts guard treasure, and we've discussed that before. In 1780, a serving woman who was getting up in years took a job with the Powys Castle in Wales. Well, at least she wanted to take a job. She went there looking for work, having been told there was an opening. And as a joke, she was offered a bed in a haunted bedroom. Now, the Lord of the Manor was out of town. Now, you would think, as so many others had, this woman would run screaming into the night because of what haunted that room. But the woman actually had the last laugh. She was awakened to find an elegantly dressed woman standing over her, who led her to a hidden locked box and showed her the key hidden in a nearby crevice. And she told her to send it to the owner of the castle, who was in London. Well, the old woman did exactly as the ghost told her to do. The owner returned to the castle, and the old woman told him again what the ghost had told her. The owner went into that room, found the key, opened the box, and just stared at it for some time. Then he closed the box and put the key in his pocket. And he came back and he treated the old woman as a member of his family. He supported her until her death. He never said what he found. He offered her any money she wanted, and she became a permanent member of his household. Not the staff, his household. You never know what ghosts return for. Sometimes they come to bring messages. The vast majority, according to a number of British researchers, seem to be ghosts of conscience. Victims of injustice appealing to the living for a decent burial or perhaps for wishes to be kept. Or just hoping for sympathy, understanding. Some seek peace. Others object to their peace being disturbed. Raynham Hall is a magnificent home near Fakenham in Norfolk. And it's been haunted for nearly 300 years by a woman dressed in brown. She's believed to be the ghost of Dorothy Walpole, who was the sister of Britain's Prime Minister in 1721. Her father was a member of Parliament, was made guardian of a 13-year-old Viscount, Charles Townsend. Now, the Townsend family was unbelievably wealthy. And the only heir was this 13-year-old boy. And as Dorothy and Charles grew up, they naturally fell in love and they wanted to get married. But Dorothy's father said no, because he didn't want people to think he had used his position as guardian to marry his daughter off to this very wealthy young man. So Charles eventually met and married a baron's daughter, but Dorothy was a hard-headed, headstrong young woman, and she couldn't shake her feelings off that easily. She went to London, then Paris, scandalizing the social set by moving in with a member of the nobility and setting up housekeeping without bothering to get married. In 1711, Dorothy heard that Charles's wife had died, and she hurried home. And within a year, they were married, and they were unbelievably happy. And then Charles heard the gossip about what Dorothy had done in Paris. He was furious and confined her to her room. She wasn't allowed out. No one was allowed in. Who is sponsoring the show tonight? Well, the second hour is sponsored by Golden Corral, 7420 North Mesa. They have got a buffet that will absolutely keep you enthralled with food. They've got almost every type of food you can imagine. They've got a salad bar that you won't be able to work your way through. And they have got the every type of fish you can picture. And desserts, you'll gain 10 pounds just looking at them. Now, the beauty of it is their prices are so reasonable that you don't have to take out a second mortgage to take the family out to dinner. And if you tell them you heard about it on the Ken Hudnall Show, they will give you 10% off your bill. The Golden Corral is a great place to eat. It's a varied menu. And you will see that we will be adding a number of different advertisers who will be sponsoring this show. And all you have to do in order to help this show grow is go to our advertisers. You know, with Marcello's, I've got dinner for two or $25 gift card, which should cover dinner for two. But no one is trying to guess when I started radio and where I started radio. And in fact, I even mentioned it tonight. Golden Corral, all you got to do is go in and say you heard about it. Or you go to Twitter or Facebook, and there are coupons there that give you 10% off. I do my best to try to get you the best savings I can, and all you got to do is go take advantage of it. Now, I appreciate you reminding me I did not mention who sponsored this hour. And beginning Monday, we should have another major sponsor. And it's, you know, the show is growing. We're going to be adding very shortly a shortwave edition of this show. Those that don't want to listen on the computer, if you have a shortwave radio, you'll be able to hear this same show. We're always trying to do something different and something better in order to please the audience. Now, after 10 years of being locked in her room by her angry spouse, she died. Now, according to the official records, she died of smallpox. How she could have gotten smallpox locked in her room is anybody's guess, but the records say smallpox. However, the local rumor was that The local rumor was she was at the top of the stairs and she was helped down the stairs with a hard shove. Her ghost was seen by servants, family, and guests alike because she was wanting justice. And you can't blame her. In 1786, George III was staying there. And he woke in the middle of the night to see this woman dressed in brown, her hair disheveled, her face ashen, standing beside his bed. Well, even kings freak out. He went running down the hall in his nightgown and nightcap, aroused everybody in the house. And he said he wouldn't stay in that house 1 hour longer. Now, the Townsend family went to great lengths to calm the king. I mean, after all, pissing off the king could get your head cut off. So he ordered his groundskeepers to keep a watch to make sure that the ghost didn't get the king again. And a few nights later, they saw the woman in brown walking down a corridor. One man moved in front of her and demanded to know who she was as she walked right through him. Now, in 1833, she appeared again. The then Lady Townsend had a brother who was a colonel in the army. And this brother, a very level-headed individual, saw her on consecutive nights at Christmas. Now, Christmas is a popular time with ghosts, at least according to many of the stories. And he described her as a stately woman in rich brown brocade with a cap-like headdress. Everything, she looked like a living, breathing creature, except where her eyes should have been, there were black hollows. And the appearance of a ghost tended to disrupt the Christmas festivities. A few years later, Captain Frederick Marryat, author of Mr. Midshipman Easy and a number of other books, was staying there as a guest. He was a tough, seagoing man who claimed not to be afraid of the devil himself. Well, Marryat stayed at the hall in a room with a portrait of Dorothy Townsend hanging on the wall. And late that night, he and two other guests saw the ghost of Dorothy Townsend walking down the hall. They ran into a side room as the phantom approached, but it stopped in the doorway and grinned at them. Marryat was unnerved. But he had enough presence of mind to grab his pistol and fire a shot. Went straight through the ghost and embedded itself in the wall behind her. Being shot at may have annoyed her. Her appearances became infrequent after that. But two professional photographers in 1936 were taking photographs in Raynham Hall. And they had set up their cameras at the bottom of the steps. And took one of the most famous photos of a ghost in history. Experts have examined the photos and declare that they are not doctored. In Chamber Crombie Manor in Devon, a tall, lovely woman dressed in gray has been seen often joining the tours that tour her manor, or the home that used to be hers before it was open to the public. Now, she had every reason to be as angry as Dorothy, but for some reason she has never shown that side of her personality. The story began with her grandfather, one of the notorious West Country shipwreckers of 400 years ago. During storms, he used to wave lanterns to draw unsuspecting ships to crash upon the shore, and then he would plunder them, killing any survivors, of course. One day, his son followed him and rescued a Spanish girl who had survived the wreck. She was a beautiful young lady. And they married and had a daughter named Kate. The family had left Chamber Crombie Manor by then, embarrassed by the wrecking activities, and William and his family, because that was the name of the son, lived on Lundy Island in the Bristol Channel. But they heard that the family had moved out of the manor and they rented it. Now, shortly after, their daughter Kate married an Irish sea captain and moved with them to Dublin, Ireland. Years passed. Then one night there was a vicious storm. Ted on line two. When I finish this story, if you'll bring it on, Heidi. William went down to the beach just in case a ship ran aground. And he found a woman lying on the rocks, badly injured. He carried her up to the manor house, where she died very shortly. Now, she was wearing jewels, and it was a great temptation for William. Around her waist, she had a money belt, which was full to bursting with jewels and money. And he knew with what she was carrying, he could buy the manor home outright. So when a man from the Admiralty arrived looking for the passenger. He said he knew nothing about it. Now remember, she had been battered by the waves. Disfigured horribly. Dying in intense pain. Well, it turns out that the passenger was Kate, his daughter. And lest there be repercussions about him lying to the Admiralty, he walled her up in one of the rooms in the manor. And shortly after, he moved. Well, 150 years later, a farmer living in the manor home found Kate's skeleton while rethatching the roof. Her bones were buried in a pauper's grave at Ilfracombe. But her spirit still wanders the manor. In fact, as recently as 1976, her ghost has been seen wandering the beach. Heidi, would you bring on Ted, please? How are you?
I'm great, man. How are you?
Oh, I'm having a fun time.
Are we getting feedback, by the way?
No. At least not on this end.
I'm getting it on my end. I don't mind. But I just hope our audience isn't hearing it.
I think I would hear it if, or at least I would hear something if it was going out.
Okay, then we're all right. Now, I think that the picture I'm going to discuss tonight, although it's not about the paranormal, has a lot of paranormal action going on.
Okay.
I went to see Winter's Bone.
Carla is saying that you are echoing.
Ask Heidi if I should hang up and dial in again.
Heidi, should he hang up and dial in again? Going once. Going twice. She's not saying.
She's not saying, probably because the little one has her too busy.
Certainly that is a possibility.
I'm the last guest of the evening.
That is
also
correct.
I'm not echoing anymore.
Heidi says you're fine on her end.
And okay.
I don't know what you're doing on her end, but that's okay.
All right. Tell her fabulous.
And
now,
listening to the computer, she says.
Yeah, I keep forgetting that Heidi's listening to everything we say.
That is correct.
Okay. Where would we be without the famous Heidi?
Well, there's others that have said, but we'll never know.
Well, I went to see Winter's Bone.
She said you make her feel like a stalker, but go ahead.
I do?
Yeah.
You mean I make her feel like I'm a stalker or she's a stalker?
She's a stalker.
She's a stalker? Oh, no. Heidi is like the mother hen. We love her. Okay?
That would be kind of foul if she was the mother hen, but go ahead.
Only if you're speaking of feathered animals.
Well, we wouldn't want a chicken out. Let's go ahead and talk about it.
All right. No, we absolutely adore Heidi. So here's the story of Winter's Bone. This is a picture that proves my point that great movies rarely make it to film festivals. This was the winner of the Grand Jury Prize at Sundance.
Yes.
Not only for Best Picture, but for best writer.
Okay.
And I'm thinking to myself, if this is what they come out of at Sundance and call the best, there has to be a reason. And I think the reason is that really top major studio productions that people absolutely believe in generally do not make it to film festivals. They generally don't need a film festival to get publicity.
Okay.
This Winter's Bone picture cost $2 million to make. And for a $2 million picture, it's actually quite excellent. But it's not a great movie. I'm going to give it probably 2.5 to 3 stars. I haven't written a review yet. But it's been around to festival after festival after festival after festival. Now, the interesting thing about it is that Anne Russellini, who co-wrote the screenplay with the director, Deborah Granick, also produced a picture in 2004 called Down to the Bone. And she has only 3 pictures on her credits. One every 3 years, actually. Down to the Bone was her first picture. It cost, according to, there's no budget, according to IMDb. How about that? Then her next picture cost $750,000, and Winter's Bone cost $2 million. Well, at least she's moving up in the world. Anyway, she must have a thing about bones. Now, you don't see a lot of bones in this picture, which is kind of interesting. This is the plot. I'm going to give it to you in a nutshell. Jennifer Lawrence, who's a rather popular young actress, she's only 19 years old, plays Ree Dolly in a kind of hillbilly place in the Ozarks. I guess you could call it hillbilly. The filmmakers call it hillbilly. I'm not sure what hillbillies are. But there are pieces of indoor furniture outdoors, a great many tires, some still mounted on their rims, used ones piled up in, you know, somebody's front lawn, lots and lots of pickup trucks, and so many guys who wear caps, blue jeans, and plaid shirts that you really need a scorecard to tell who is who.
Well, before you can determine if it's hillbilly, are there any cars on cinder blocks in the front yard?
I didn't see any of that.
Then
but I
not
did,
hear of hillbillies.
I did see them skinning squirrels.
Well, that's a good start, but if you don't have a car on cinder blocks, you're not a hillbilly.
Really? Well, then I guess, you know, that has to be in the front yard, right?
Usually, yeah.
I mean, if you have it in the backyard, then you're just a shade tree mechanic, right?
Exactly.
Okay. I just wanted to be clear on that.
If your mother keeps a spit cup on the end of the ironing board, you might be a redneck.
Well, you know, one of the problems with this movie, and I'm digressing, is that they tried to make it very authentic. And here's the problem for urban audiences. And I think that urban audiences are the greatest consumers of film. We're trying to listen to the Ozark accent. Sometimes you gotta subtitle it. By the time we get our ears attuned to it, now this is a 100-minute movie, 1 hour and 40 minutes. By the time we get our ears attuned to it, we've missed half the picture.
That can happen.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I was kept trying to get a good fix on the license plates of these cars that were in the movie, and I was trying to read the state. I wasn't trying to read the license number, and you know that states in the past two decades have gotten kind of ridiculous about putting advertising on their license plates.
Yep.
You know, I liked it a lot better when they just had the name of the state and the number on the tag. Okay? That was a lot easier. The Brits, by the way, do it differently. They don't give you the tag. They give the car the tag. And when you sell the car, the tag goes with it. Okay?
Okay.
Very interesting. Apparently, U.S. and Canada do it the same way. So when we try to figure out where a vehicle is from, it's very difficult because it used to be that they put the name of the state in big letters,
yeah,
and the only thing bigger was the license number.
Yeah.
Okay? Now they put the name of the state in small letters, and then they put a couple of lines of advertising about the state. For example, the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania a few years back put their website on the license plates, www.pa.state.us.gov or something like that.
Yeah.
Okay? And I'm like, oh, for crying out loud. And Rhode Island has had for a long time the Ocean State. And New York has the Empire State, and I don't know if you've noticed last time you visited New York, but New York is bringing back orange and black license plates.
I saw that.
Yeah, but they're not like the old ones. The old ones used to have NY and then the numbers.
Yeah.
Now they have New York in Times Roman, up at the top, in orange, against a black background.
Yeah.
Underneath, they have the tag number. And then at the bottom, they have the Empire State. Duh. You know, I know New York is the Empire State. Okay? I know Florida is the Sunshine State. I know I have a friend in Pennsylvania. Do I really need to be told this on the license plates of cars?
Well, people don't want you to forget.
Oh, is that it?
Yeah, you might forget.
The problem is you cram too much copy on the license plate, and the license plate becomes difficult to read. Now, I am absolutely certain that there's a paranormal reason for this.
Well, of course.
I mean, there's probably the ghosts of some prisoners who didn't like making license plates. And they're all upset about it. And they came around and they haunted the motor vehicle departments of the 50 states and basically messed up all our tags.
I would go with that.
Okay. Now, Jennifer Lawrence at age 19 is actually a very compelling actress. I'm going to tell you the story. It opens with Jennifer Lawrence living in what appears to be some sort of log cabin. I'm not sure whether it has more than one room, although it's a fairly large room as rooms go, with a mother who does not utter a word the entire film and apparently went crazy on account of the ups and downs of her husband, who never appears in the picture. It seems that her husband was arrested for cooking crystal meth. It also seems that this group of people in this community in the Ozarks are somehow all related to each other.
Well, now, that's stretching the imagination. If you said Arkansas, I'd agree with you.
I thought it was Arkansas when they said Ozarks, but then I read some of the production notes, and it seems that they shot it in Missouri, which is across the river from Arkansas.
True. And most of the reasons that those in Arkansas didn't go to Missouri is certain things don't float.
Is that it?
Yeah.
Well, you know, some of the stuff reminded me of people I grew up with. For example, Kevin Bresnahan, who's a fairly competent actor, plays a fellow called Little Arthur. I knew guys in New Jersey named Little Arthur. They weren't necessarily little.
That's true.
Usually it was because their father was named Arthur and was known as Big Arthur. And when they were Little Arthur. And Little Arthur stuck with them well into their 80s.
Yeah.
You know, but any case, guy's arrested for making crystal meth. And he posts a bond. He posts the property his family lives on, which is his daughter, Jennifer Lawrence, the oldest, who plays a 17-year-old. Now, a 19-year-old is a 17-year-old. That usually is rather difficult. You usually have to cast an actress who's about 25 who really can act, because she'll have enough experience to play the younger girl, and you just dress her down, you know, wipe the makeup off her face, that kind of thing.
Yeah.
This girl really does a compelling job, and I got to give her credit. She plays Ree Dolly. Now, her missing dad is Jessup Dolly, okay? And her dad's older brother, also known as her uncle, is played by John Hawkes. The character is Teardrop Dolly. Okay, you are familiar with the Sicilian concept of omerta?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. All these guys are in the drug business. Uncle Teardrop is usually walking around with a bag of cocaine big enough. If it were flour, he'd be making waffles. Now, I don't know where guys in the Ozarks who are driving 25-year-old pickup trucks and haven't had a shave in 3 weeks get the money for that much cocaine.
Good question.
I'll say. I mean, my God. I mean, this guy had enough to get a whole neighborhood high. And he keeps pulling out the plastic bag and taking out his little spoon, the teeny tiny, you know, the little 1/8-inch spoon.
Yeah.
And tooting up. And Jennifer Lawrence does a very good job of playing a girl who does not like drugs. She actually has a dream to join the army, which when you think about where she's coming from, at least it'll get her away from spare tires that were not, from old tires rather, that were not put there for a reason.
All right.
I mean, seriously, if you're using old tires in a war zone, it's to create a really disgusting, long-lasting fire.
That's true.
Okay. Or, as they did in South Africa, they used to use them to necklace people. Remember necklacing?
Yep.
Okay. This is before Mandela took over. And there was a lot of that going on. Yeah, they'd take a burning tire and put it around the guy's neck and basically either kill him or mutilate him. Either way, it wasn't pleasant. Now, everybody in the town, if you could call it a town, is in the drug business. And I say if you could call it a town, because it seems that everyone is spread out. And for some reason, Jessup, who is the missing guy, who's jumped bail allegedly, and you know, the picture opens with the bail bondsman coming to the house and telling Ree, first asking Ree where her parents, her mother is, and she says, you best tell me because she ain't going to listen, because her mother doesn't do much listening. She's mildly catatonic. She also has a little brother who's 12 and a little sister who's 6, and she is the sole support thereof, including the mother. So, her neighbors tend to be a little helpful, you know, they'll bring extra food and stuff like that, but this girl really is the family spark plug. She's the breadwinner. She's the one who teaches the two kids how to shoot squirrels and other animals for food. And she's come across by a girlfriend when she's showing them how to fire a gun. And she said, and the girlfriend says, what are all the guns about? Says, I'm just giving them some lessons in survival. Okay. I can buy that. My grandfather got arrested on a number of occasions for poaching in Italy on the estates of aristocrats. And they did that because the people didn't have enough to eat.
Yeah.
Well, all well and good. Now, the bail bondsman tells Jennifer Lawrence's character, Ree Dolly, that your dad put up the house and the surrounding property, but it wasn't enough to make bail, and some guy came and put down a lot of cash and didn't give his name. Wanted him out of there real fast for whatever reason. And she says, well, what's going to happen? She says, well, since your dad put up the title to the property as his bond, and since he's not showing up for his court date, we're going to take the house and the surrounding yard. Now, there's also a apparently additional acreage of forest.
Yeah.
That the father did not own, which for some reason either the mother or the girl owns. I don't know what the deal is. It's not quite spelled out, but the fellow on the land does not have title to it. So, you know, they would be, if all of the manure hit the air conditioner, these people would be forced to go and live in the woods because that's all they'd own.
Yeah.
Well, you know, it's winter. They call it winter's bone.
Yeah.
There are no leaves on the trees. There are no, I mean, you know, this is like, there are icicles here and there. And there's no snow on the ground, which I found rather interesting. I thought it snowed in the Ozarks.
Well, it does from time to time.
Yeah, but do you figure you could get a 2-week period where it doesn't snow?
Probably.
Yeah? All right. She says to the sheriff, I'll find him. And she goes out, and nobody wants to tell her anything, and they keep telling her to stop looking. So she goes to this relative, this friend, that friend, and eventually comes to the head of the local, I guess, syndicate, if you will.
Yes.
Gets turned away and then comes back at him. When she comes back at him, she gets beaten unconscious. Now, what's interesting about this little town or region or whatever you want to call it is I never see anybody touch a telephone, but everybody knows everything that's going on.
Well,
they know what everyone said, and they know what everyone did.
That's typical.
Well, you could have knocked me down with a fender. quote Gracie Allen.
Yeah.
What I would like to know is, how does news travel that fast? Is it jungle drums?
No, it's one person telling another one, and it's just running like wildfire.
Well, the distances between houses are so great. You know, you're talking a day's walk to get from one house to another. And I'm thinking to myself, why yom, as we say in Italian? What the heck is going on here?
Well, you got to understand that there's something about the South, and that's part of the South. I used to suspect it was the party line, because everybody had party lines. It didn't have...
I remember the party line when I was a little kid.
Yeah, and sometimes it was, the milkman would go around and not only deliver milk, he'd deliver gossip.
Ah, yeah, but you know, these guys didn't have the milkman. They had livestock.
Well, you may have had a cow that caught more than it should.
Well, turns out she finds out that her dad was a snitch. He was looking at 10 years.
Yes.
So he started filling in the authorities. And apparently that's why he got sprung so quickly on bail.
Yeah.
And then she is led to believe that her dad is dead. Turns out that the dad is dead. Well, of course, if the dad is dead, then he doesn't have to show up for his court appearance because he can't try a dead guy. And it is never revealed in the picture who did the guy in.
Yes.
But her uncle, who starts out, her uncle Teardrop, who's played by John Hawkes, who's a very capable actor. He's 50 years old. Doesn't look it, but God, did they ever make him look like an old man in the picture. This is the guy with the cocaine up his nose.
Yeah.
Her uncle Teardrop, interestingly enough, starts out very hostile.
Yes.
And ends up her closest ally. Go figure.
Or
and comes to rescue her when she gets beat up.
She's 17, and I'm sure he was entertaining various thoughts.
That doesn't come across in the picture at all.
Then he's dead.
Well, with all he had up his nose and all the cigarettes he smoked, he probably was. I mean, this is what the other thing that amazed me. These guys all do too many drugs. Everybody in the area is an amateur chemist, if you get what I mean.
Yes.
And they all smoke too much. I got to figure by age 40, they've had it.
Well, now, you're probably being unduly harsh. You have to remember that there wasn't a lot of recreation around there, so...
Well, it seems to me there was plenty of hunting, plenty of fishing, and...
Now, that was work. That wasn't recreation.
That was work.
Yeah.
Well, I got to read you a little something that I got from one of my dear friends, and I think that you're going to find it amusing. This has to do with where the white man went wrong, okay? Our friend Carla from North Vancouver Island.
Yes.
Emailed me a scan of a newspaper clipping. And this was an interview with a 90-year-old Indian chief. And there's a picture of him. He certainly doesn't look 90 years old. I'd say maybe 70, but he doesn't look 90. Any case, Indian Chief Two Eagles, I'm reading the story, was asked by a white U.S. government official, and this is from a Canadian newspaper. "You have observed the white man for 90 years. You have seen his wars and his technological advances. You have seen his progress and the damage he has done." The chief nodded in agreement. The official continued, "Considering all these events, in your opinion, where did the white man go wrong?" The chief stared at the government official and then replied, quote, "When white men find land, Indians running it. No taxes, no debt, plenty buffalo, plenty beaver, clean water. Women did all the work. Medicine man free. Indian man spend all day hunting and fishing, all night having sex." The chief leaned back and smiled. "Only white man dumb enough to think he could improve system like that."
Good point.
Now, you remember the advertisement years ago, and we brought this up when we discussed the film Art and Copy?
Yeah.
The one with the Indian brave on the side of the freeway, shedding tears over all the litter that had been thrown out of cars.
Yeah.
That ran for a couple of years. Remember that ad?
Yeah, it did.
That was a good ad.
Yeah, it was.
You know, and I, look, I am not what you call a tree hugger. I have nothing against environmentalism, but I say, let's not get carried away. Let's be realistic.
Yeah.
But the idea that people should just take their trash and throw it on to public land outside of their cars...
Yes.
...is a disgrace. I mean, what are they, pigs?
Well, the reason they throw it out of the car is because they don't want to be a pig. They don't want to mess up their car.
Oh, they don't want to mess up their car. Well, most of these cars are pretty messed up to begin with.
That's why the litter bag, which was nothing but a plastic bag, hung on the radio knob, was business for a while.
Yeah, well, of course, when the radios became digital, the knobs got a lot smaller, and you couldn't hang the litter bag on the radio knob.
That's right.
Okay? And then when they went to front-wheel drive, the humps got smaller, and you couldn't put those little rubbish baskets on the hump.
That's right.
You know, the ones with the weights on each side at the bottom?
Yeah.
And so on and so forth. What I do is I just, you know, pull over at the... you know, the nearest gas station and throw everything in the trash can.
As cars became humpless, it caused a great many problems.
Well, my car has a giant hump. And no place to put anything. So if you have litter, you have to live with it until the next gas station. Any case, we got to get back to the movie. This picture, for $2 million, I was amazed. And I swear the only way they did it for $2 million is they did not hire name actors. If you go through the credits of the people in this picture, they are not fabulous credits. But everybody did a very convincing job. My objections to it were that even at 100 minutes long, it took all of 50 minutes to get up to steam. My other objection was the lack of comic relief and the utterly lugubrious soundtrack. I mean, you couldn't have got a soundtrack that was much worse. Now, once we figure that the guy is dead, Jessup.
Yeah.
Jessup Dolly, who's on the lam. Apparently this whole area is populated by offshoots of the Dolly family.
Introducing new French's, honey.
What?
Kissing song.
Hello?
Yes?
What's that on the air?
I think that's Heidi singing.
Really? I think Heidi should stick to being a producer.
That's a unique singing voice.
I'll say it is. I mean, you know, that's approaching Gracie Allen.
Well, the world needs another Gracie.
It sure does. Any case, the, you know, I looked at the credits of these guys, and you know there's one guy whose credit, big credit, was The Perfect Getaway.
Yes.
You remember that picture? We talked about it where this couple go to Hawaii and all kinds of strange things happen. Timothy Oliphant was the star.
Mm-hmm.
It was an awful movie. Now, I went through the cast, and I noticed that their credits generally tended to be these offbeat, kind of country-ish, kind of, you know, movies about lowlifes. And I'm thinking, maybe there's a little typecasting going on here.
Could be, but work is work.
Work is work. Hey, I'd do it, you know, if the pay is there. But at $2 million, I'll bet you only $1 million went to the cast. And this one has a pretty big cast. So that you start carving up that million. Then you figure the agents take and the managers take. You're barely paying the rent.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'm looking, for example, the guy. Oh, you want to hear what's funny? Revelation?
Yeah.
The guy who ratted out the Joe Jessup character?
Yeah.
Was Sheriff Baskin, the law in this area. Well, it so happens that he's played by Garrett Dillahunt, whose last major credit was The Road. Remember that one? The one where the world, all life on Earth had ended, except for a few people. Yeah, we discussed it. It
certainly rings a bell, but I can't.
He was also in, try this one, No Country for Old Men,
yeah,
and The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford.
Ah, yes.
Okay. Now, The Assassination, No Country for Old Men at least had its funny moments. The Assassination of Jesse James by the Coward Robert Ford was a terrible movie. I mean, this is where, if you didn't know who he was, you'd think that Brad Pitt was a coal mine in Wales.
All right.
Okay. So, you know, I'm looking at the, and this is what I mean by we got a little typecasting. Now, the guy is also known for One Life to Live. And he's 45 years old, and I'll give him credit for not looking it. And he's all of 6 feet, 2 inches tall. Amazing what you can find out when you check things on IMDb. Well, he was convincing as a weasel. And what ends up happening in this picture, and I'm going to give away the ending because this is, it's a little ridiculous. This is the one moment when everybody in the theater laughed. The girlfriend of the capo of the town, the crime gang, the girlfriend of the guy who has our Jennifer Lawrence person beaten up.
Yes.
at the end, she comes to see, and this is in the final reel, she comes to see Ree Dolly and tells her, come on, we're going to show you where your father is. And then she takes her out at night on some body of water. I don't know if it's a creek or a pond or whatever it is, but it's a body of water, and it is far enough from the coast to be fresh water.
Yeah.
And she says, he should be right about there. He ain't too deep. Reach down and grab him.
Okay.
Well, she grabs him. Of course, the kid freaks out a little. And then the lady, who's played by, believe, Dale Dickey. Yeah, Dale Dickey, Merab. And says an interesting and very interesting credit list. For example, she was also in A Perfect Getaway.
Yeah.
She was Earth Mama. She was one of the people in the tourist shop in Hawaii selling stuff for the trek.
Yeah.
She was in Changeling. She was in Trailer Park of Terror. She was in Domino, The Sordid Lives, The Journey of August King, and The Incredibly True Adventure of Two Girls in Love, which had a budget of all of $250,000 in 1995. Now, I'm not saying this to demean her in any way, but I am saying it seems like the actors in this picture have been bumping up against each other like gas molecules in Brownian movement for a very long time. You get where I'm going?
Yep.
All right. So, I think the producers had a very, very good pool of talent. And this time, at least they had halfway decent material for them. I think I might give the picture 3 stars, because I have to take into account the fact that it cost only $3 million to make. $2 million, rather. And if you can make something look good on $2 million, then, you know, you may have a future. Problem is, I think the appeal is going to be limited because it has an R rating. Now, there is absolutely no sex in this picture. So all you out there in Radio Land who have prurient minds, give it up. But there is a little bit of violence. Not a lot, just a little. For example, when Ree Dolly is beaten up by the minions of Mr. Big.
Yes.
We don't see it. The garage door goes down, the overhead door, and we hear some screams and moans, and then we have her eye view of the people surrounding her blurry as she slowly regains consciousness, which I thought was a very good way of filming it. You don't have to show guys beating up a 17-year-old girl.
True.
It's unnecessary. The other thing, however, I think that probably got it the R rating, and there were 2 things. Very little language, by the way. Very little. The other thing I think that got it the R rating was the drug use. And think about this for a minute. Skinning a squirrel. Now, I didn't stay for all the credits, but I did not see anywhere the disclaimer that no animals were harmed in the making of this film. My guess is that no animals were harmed, and these squirrels were already dead. But you never know. You never know.
The members of the Film Actors Guild.
In which case, I'm sure there's a union death benefit.
Exactly.
But there's one other thing about the picture that probably got it the rating. And that's when they come across the body of Jessup under the shallow water.
Yes.
And the Dale Dickey character,
yes.
Merab, whips out a chainsaw. And this is where the audience started laughing. And says to the Jennifer Lawrence person, take the chainsaw and cut off both his hands. And that way you can prove that he's dead and you get to keep the house. Well, she freaks out, so the Merab person does the cutting. And it gets a little gory, although they don't shoot it gory. You know what's going on. You know, she's cutting off some guy's hand just above the wrist with a chainsaw.
Yes.
Whatever happened to butcher knives and hacksaws? I mean, my mom's cousin was a butcher, and that's what they used.
Yeah, but you got to remember, anything you can motorize works better.
Is that it?
That's it.
And I was thinking very briefly, Texas Chainsaw Massacre.
Of course.
Okay, so this picture's Texas Chainsaw Massacre moment. And it, instead of inspiring horror in the audience, it was funny. And when Reed Dolly then takes her dad's two hands in a plastic bag covering up a burlap sack to the sheriff.
Yes.
And he opens them, opens the bag, the look on his face is priceless. Well, he said the lab's gonna have to find out. Says whether or not it's his hands. Well, of course, the lab finds out it's his hands. And he says, how'd this stuff get here? How'd you come across these? He says, somebody tossed them on my porch in the middle of the night. Omerta.
That happens.
Yeah. Everybody has something going on. This place is so crooked. And what I would like to know is why, out in God's country,
yeah,
all these people are doing cocaine and cooking crack. I mean, they got fresh air, a relatively unspoiled environment. No, they are not rich. I understand that. But all the blessings that nature can give them, and they got to go mess it up with drugs and bullets?
Well, of course.
Hey, maybe we should expand the Indian reservations.
Well,
am I going to get in trouble for saying Indian?
Probably, but what the heck?
All right. Just asking. So, any event, can you have my rave on this?
Yep.
I think that we need to find a better way of dealing with this. And I understand that things like crystal meth, they're always going to be around. And this is my rave on this whole subject. The money in that stuff is not in the product, it's in the protection.
Yeah.
And if you take the product, make it legal, and subject it to tax, about the only thing you're going to get is the modern-day equivalent of moonshiners trying to outrun the revenue agents.
But that's true.
I never heard of a moonshiner getting shot.
Oh, it happened all the time.
Did it?
Yeah, you hit the car full of moonshine, it's going to blow up anyway.
Oh, well, I didn't know that. I just figured you could pour it down the gas tank if you had to.
Well, now that's true, too.
You know, I mean, car in Brazil, 50% of the automobiles run on ethanol.
But a lot of folks, you mess with somebody still, you're going to get shot.
Now, why would anyone want to mess with somebody else's still? It would probably just catch fire.
Well, that's true. However, if the revenuers are out there, that's messing with somebody's livelihood.
Well, the revenuers don't count.
Well, where I came from, most of them couldn't count.
You gotta love that. So how could they count the bottles?
Well,
I mean, didn't they put most of that in Coca-Cola bottles?
That and gallon jugs.
Yeah. Yeah, they used to call the stuff white lightning. And you were lucky if you didn't get a guy who put his still together with lead solder.
That's true.
You know, I mean, you had to use solder without lead. Because if you used solder with lead, the stuff was poisonous.
Yeah, but most of what would have been poisonous would have been killed by the moonshine anyway.
No, I understand that, but we're talking about the chemicals in it, not the, the bacteria or the viruses or that sort of thing.
And since a lot of the stills had car radiators as part of them, You got, you know, antifreeze and everything else.
Good grief. Didn't they flush them out before they installed them?
Are you kidding?
No, I'm not kidding.
Well,
I know what ethylene glycol can do to you.
Yeah, some places it couldn't do much more than already been done.
Well, this is why I say when I become president, we are going to have a special treaty of alliance with Scotland. Okay? I think the price of good scotch has gone way too high, and I'm extremely upset about it. And I think we must do something for the American people by negotiating a guaranteed supply of single malt for the U.S.
Well, it's already considered very valuable after all. Quite a number of places in New York advertise Scotch Guard.
Do they?
Yeah.
Heavens to Betsy. It was advertised, I believe, once when I bought a car. They told me the interior had Scotch Guard.
That's right. It means you can't mess it. You can't drop your scotch on the seat.
Yeah, if you do, it's going to make a mess.
That's true, too.
You know what I did not see in this picture, which amazed me?
Sex.
Alcohol. Plenty of drugs, no alcohol.
Well, now, that's almost un-American, that part of the country.
Well, there you go. Here's the other piece of the puzzle. Almost every daylight scene, and the scene where they sawed off the guy's hands.
Yes.
Was shot day for night. I have never liked day for night. Using filters. to suggest night.
Yeah.
It's very difficult, and the only way it works is if you're shooting a very bright moonlit night. That's the only way it's plausible. Otherwise, it looks like you're shooting a daytime scene that is not working. Okay?
Yeah.
Now, you remember the movie Day for Night?
Vaguely.
It was the winner Best Foreign Film Oscar 1973, and it was also Best of the Show at the Lincoln Center Film Festival. By the way, if you really want to see good pictures at a film festival, the New York International Film Festival at Lincoln Center, to my thinking, still trumps all of them.
Okay.
Now, the reason they called the picture Day for Night was because in French, in the original French, it was called La Nuit Américaine. And that is the French phrase for shooting with filters in the daytime to pretend that it's night.
Yeah.
And that was developed because in the early days of film, you could not shoot at night and get a picture that anyone could see, unless you shot with bright lights. And there was no way you could shoot a scene that was supposed to be in the dark, or at the very least, lit by moonlight, and make it convincing. Unless, of course, it was on an ocean liner, and your backdrop was the black ocean, and you had lighting ostensibly from the deck lights.
Okay.
Or, for example, you're in, what was that movie with Burt Lancaster where they painted the top of the train white? Do I have to look that up?
You got me on that one.
All right. I'm gonna punch up Burt Lancaster. I'm going to get you the movie because it's a famous movie, and it's a really excellent one. Lancaster... Okay, Burt Lancaster, we're going to look it up now. Burt Lancaster, yeah, that's the guy. Okay, we're going back to the 1960s. The Train, I think it was called The Train. Yep, that was the picture. 1944, there's a German colonel headed from Paris to Germany with a train load full of French art treasures. And the resistance has to stop it without damaging the cargo. Burt Lancaster was the star.
Yeah.
And what they did, which was amazing, John Frankenheimer directed it. What they did in the picture was... And a lot of it was shot at night, but they had railroad stations. So the lights were on at the railroad stations.
Yeah.
And they were able to get real night shots of train stations where the guys in the resistance were putting up different signs to fool the Germans as to where they were going. And then, of course, the Germans figured out where they were, and they realized that they weren't where they were supposed to be, and, you know, all the manure hit the air conditioner, and a couple of guys get shot, and a few other things happened. But it's a really good movie, and I highly recommend it to everyone, even though it's 133 minutes long.
Okay.
You can get it from Netflix, which, by the way, rhymes with TEDflix.
That's true.
Except I spell it TEDFLICKS.com.
Well, unfortunately, we've run out of time.
Heavens to Betsy.
Yep. So I guess we will have to adjourn our movie discussion until
next week.
That's right.
All right, Ken, it has indeed been a pleasure.
Yep.
And I'm looking forward to next week.
Well, I will talk to you then.
Okay, thank you so much.
You're quite welcome.
It's been a pleasure, and I hope our audience enjoyed our discussion of an independent film.
Well, my guess would be that they did.
Yes, even with our musical interlude.
That was bizarre.
Obviously, ghosts.
Yep, Ghost in the Machine. Well, I appreciate you being with me, and I'll talk to you later.
Okay, thank you, Ken, and take care.
Bye-bye.
I'm signing off. Bye-bye.
Well, until tomorrow night at 6, this is Ken Hudnall for The Ken Hudnall Show saying have a truly great evening. And once again, we have our problem starting the music.